Accession number 26755, Reel 2.
Devon, to a workshop just outside Colombton. And that was a lovely little place there. I was there for the summer of 43. And we had a sports day there. We used to go out for PT every morning and jog along at the double, and then for the last half mile or so, a free-for-all, when we used to run back to camp. I'll have to stop for a moment and turn the tape over because we'll come to the end of it. After on our sports day, one particular chef and myself from the leading half a dozen, we put our names down to do the mile. But there were only the two of us, so consequently, we were not considered. So we put it down for the 880. But still there were only the two of us. Eventually, we whittled down and put down into the 440. But for the 440, there were so many, they had to run it in two heats. And I remember when my heat, he and I were in the same heat together. And I'd had nothing to eat since breakfast. I wouldn't eat lunch in case it interfered with my running. And it was somewhat late in the afternoon before I had to run the first heat. And I followed him around the track, and then at the last 20 yards, I put on a burst and pipped him at the post. And the first three were put forward together with the first three of the other heat for the finals. And I repeated the system. Well, the track was only 220, so I had to go around twice. And at the end, again, for the last 20 yards, I put on a spurt and picked at the post again. And everybody seemed most astonished that I should do so, because nobody ever thought of me as athletic at all. And I received a £1 savings bond for my prize. Needless to say, that was soon cashed and then spent. That was a lovely little place at the Willand. It was near Tiverton Junction, which is miles from the town of Tiverton, but was a stop on the London to Cornish Riviera express run. But it was a nice little place. I hadn't done so well on the tradesman's side, and I was seconded to the regimental side of it. And I remember I was doing telephone duty one day, and we had a lot of outlying gun sites and so on, and ADS girls working on them and so on. I remember chatting to one after a while, and quite innocently, you know, talking away, and all of a sudden a couple of blokes burst into the telephone room and said, "Who's on the phone?" And I said, "I was." I was hauled up in front of the old man because there had been complaints of somebody, they said, from their camp, making indecent phone calls to the girls. Well, there was nothing indecent other than the phone calls that I had been making. And the old man backed me up. And at that particular time, I was awaiting War Office Selection Board, so I wanted to get transferred to the infantry. And he put in a good word, and the whole matter dropped. One of our staff sergeants was knocking around with a girl from a nearby village who was running a taxi service that belonged to her husband, who was in the Middle East. And whenever she came, was coming back from a run, she saw any chaps from our camp, she always used to pick them up and drop them off, because she went past our front gate on the way back home. And one night she happened to pick up a mate of mine, and chatting away to him, she said, "Do you know Ron Savage?" He said, "Yes." "She's going to marry my sister." "Who told me that?" I said, "Like hell I am. I mean, a sister was very, very promiscuous, and I was not going to be blamed for anything there." So I smartly asked for posting away, and I finished up at Way Hill, near Andover, on the Salisbury Plain. And I was doing all right there. We had one of the, again, it was a mixed unit, we had ATS girls with us, and I had a crush on one. And shortly before, about October, November, 43, I was posted up to 10th Command Workshops, where the unit was being formed for the invasion, 22nd Advanced Base Workshop. But the lads there, they said, "Well, look, come on back down for Christmas, we can put you up." So I did. And of course, I went down there with a ring in my pocket to propose to the girl. But she was out with somebody else. So bang went that. Took the ring back and dropped a quid on it, and spent it taking other girls out instead. Oh, well. Oh, that's life. Anyway, in the 22nd Advanced Base Workshops, the scheme was set up for reclamation section. The idea being that as we would be having to make an invasion across the channel, and shipping would be in strict demand, it was a case of which came first, the transport to carry the ammunition and no ammunition to take in the transport, or the ammunition and no transport to take it. So they got around that one by... instead of filling up a lot of spares, forming these sections to go around stripping any vehicles of usable parts and taking them back to the workshops. Well, that was all very well in theory. The trouble was, sometimes you'd find a truck where the driver had stopped, gone into the woods to ease springs a bit, and came back, the engine wouldn't start because very serious parts have been removed from it by a reclamation squad, and he'd left stranded. We worked all right. That was the idea. Of course, we were in a base workshop, as I say, and we landed in Normandy in August, and we spent the first night bivouacked in a large field. And strangely, for August, the night was quite chilly, so three or four of us put our ground sheets together, lay on them, and put all our blankets over the top of us, and we lay there fully dressed. We had been told by one of the officers the night before that somewhere over there, and he waved his arm in a direction of 180 degree angle, one side place to the next, there's an unlimited amount of tea at any hour of the day. So it was being rather cold. We woke up about 5 o'clock in the morning, couldn't get to sleep again, so we decided we'd go to this unlimited tea, and we would have spent ages looking for it. I couldn't find it, and eventually a huge Percheron stallion came up with a little French lad on his back, like sitting there like a little pimple. So we looked at one another and said, "Who can speak French?" And none of us could. So eventually I put a few words together and said, "Garçon, ici." The garçon duly ici'd, and I waved my mug in his direction and said, "Où est le thé? Compris? Thé, thé," in my best British soldier manner. He said, "Wee, wee," and again, waving his arms in a 180 degree arc, said, "Hala." So we wandered off over that direction, and then we saw a chap coming out with a tea bucket. They were unmistakable. As we got near, he said, "Stand back, this tea is for the guards." So, well, what about us? "Oh, you'll have to wait till breakfast at 7 o'clock. So much for tea at any hour of the day." Oh, we eventually had breakfast, and then transport came up, those huge American trucks, and we all boarded them. I thought, well, I'll be up in the fresh air, and I sat there, up on the top on the camouflage scrim behind the cabin of the truck. And I thought, fine, I'm comfortable here. What I hadn't reckoned on was it would be 4 or 5 hours on the journey to Khan. And by the time we got there, I was so stiff I had to be lifted down and couldn't move my legs for about 5 minutes. But when we settled up and settled down and the camp, and of course, well, for the first 3 or 4 days, it was murder. Well, it was a change of water or what, but everybody suffered from chippo tummy, except it was Normandy tummy. And all night long there'd be queues outside the multiple toilets until eventually it all wore off. But that's one of my unpleasant memories. And shortly after the Battle of the Falaise Gap, we were repairing tanks and all the rest of it. You know, I was taking off the sheets of armour, and a couple of jetty PWs were assigned to me to cart it away and stack it up. And they came back complaining very well, saying, "Oh, it's too heavy, more food, more food." I said, "Bloody master race, I'll show you." And picked it up, a piece of armour plating by myself, and carted it over. I regretted it for the rest of my life because I strained my back. And the doctor at the MO, he diagnosed fibrositis. It wasn't much, it never did clear up. And then when the section was supposed to go forward, and they wouldn't let me go because of my back, I made a remarkable recovery and said it was all right. It wasn't, but I wasn't going to let them know, miss out on this. And we moved forward. And eventually, we caught up with 30 Corps Troop Workshops, which by then was at Eindhoven. Well, we used to go out scouring the country in a 1500 weight Bedford, sorry, Ford Watt 6. And we had the staff sergeant in charge and a sergeant, a corporal, lance jack, and half a dozen craftsmen. The staff sergeant and sergeant, they used to go back to Brussels where they got their feet under the table, because on the way up, we had spent a week there trying to catch up on the whereabouts of the particular unit. Anyway, it left the corporal, who was driving the truck, the lance jack and the others, one of whom would stay behind, and we'd take it in turns to have a day off. And they always go scouring the countryside. And then one day, we found an army back loading point full of vehicles that had been back loaded there. They'd done a local repair. And the staff sergeant in charge was a particular friend of the corporal's. And when we explained what our job was, he said, "Well," he said, "any time you want to come here and help yourselves, you're most welcome." So we thought, goody, goody, we'll keep that one in the back of our mind. As a matter of fact, it wasn't all that long before he had to put it to use. We'd gone back into Belgium, just over the border from Holland, and while we're brewing up our McConaughey's M&V and chai at lunchtime, the local girls came around and started chatting us up. and asked us if we were coming to their dance that evening. So we said, dance? What dance? And they explained there was one in the bridge that night. So we beetled off a high speed of knots back to Eindhoven. We saw the workshop officer and said, look, we've found somewhere where we can get a lot of bits and pieces, but it would possibly require staying out overnight. That's all right, lads, he said, you go for it. It didn't seem to occur to him to wonder why we're all dressed up in our best bib and tucker. Anyway, we went out to the village and had a fine old time at the dance, and then the various girls took us back to their family homes, where we're made most welcome, and we're put up for the night. We rendezvoused in the morning, and to our consternation, the 1-6 wouldn't start. We sweated cogs. After about half an hour, we got it going, beetled off back to that back loading point I mentioned, and quickly offloaded all the things we could get our hands on that were easy and readily available. Beetled back to camp, panting with the exertion, more or less, and reporting back, sir, here was what we've got. Oh, well done, chaps, he said. Take the rest of the day off. Who said that crime didn't pay? I remember at the time of the Arnhem drop, we were going up the main road to Arnhem to see what we could pick up, and we're stuck in traffic, absolutely nose to tail. And if the jetty had come over in force, we wouldn't have stood a chance. One fellow did come over, and I remember we had some typhoons of what they call the taxi rank stooging around, and one of the ground force liaison rough types contacted them, and they came down and made short work of that 109F. We got fed up being stuck there, so I decided to get out of the track and walk into a little farmyard where there's some British troops were making their presence known. I walked up to the intelligence office, big notice outside, smartly knocked on the door, marched in, and said to the officer there, could you tell us where we are on the map? He said, yes, he said, here, map reference, so and so and so and so. I thank you very much, and made a note of it. By the way, where's Jerry from here? Oh, he said, don't bother about your map. You see that hedge down there, the end of the field? I said, yes. He said, they dug in there. Well, I came back and saw our chaps who, in the meantime, had been having another brew up of McConaughey's M&V and what have you. And I said, don't let me bother you, chaps, but Jerry's just over the way there. I've never seen M&V disappear so quick. Not long after that, we moved out of Eindhoven and went to a little place called Geldrop. We took over a workshop there, and the unit was billeted and had to sleep in the workshops, apart from the officers who had their billets out of camp. My pal and I, we had found a bivvy in the grounds, which had been left by somebody previously with a double thickness of tarpaulin over it, which made nice insulation. It was just big enough for two single beds. We had made our beds out of strips of canvas that I'd picked up in Normandy and had stitched together, and we stuck and rested them on bricks. And we've been using those for ages, so they work very well in this little bivvy. And we had a biscuit tin turned upside down, filled with bricks, and of course the lid had been cut out. And we punched holes in the bottom and a hole in the side. And we used to take it in turns in this bitter cold weather to get up and light a blow lamp, stick it through the opening at the side, and within 2 minutes the bivvy was as hot as you could wish for. We'd then go and join the queue for breakfast, and by the time we got from the first end with our porridge in one mess tin and a soyous link sausages and what have you, and mug of tea at the other end, everything was stone cold. But back into the bivvy, and on top of that little stove, it was cooked up in no time. We really didn't believe in roughing it, well, we didn't have to. A sore point with us was the fact that we were not allowed to get ourselves fixed up with the local population, although the commissioned officers, they were quids in. However, my mate and I, we got our feet under the table with one particular family, and eventually they offered us a bed in a spare room. Well, we'd jumped at the offer. But rather stupidly, I wrote half a dozen letters in which I mentioned this particular happening. And in those days, they had what they called a green envelope, which actually is buff, but was printed on the outside in green. And you used it to circumvent the unit censors. You could send a letter direct to UK, and it wouldn't go through any censor at all. Or you could put up the 5 in it, with separate envelopes, of course, and it would go to a sensor at base. What I forgot, I was, and with the 6th one, it went through the unit sensor. One of the officers picked up my remarks, and very smartly I was sent back to Normandy. I was most upset. My pal and I had been together all that time, and now we were split up. I wouldn't let on who the other bloke was. And, of course, all they could do was thump me. Back at Normandy and with the 22nd Advanced Base Workshops, we were there over Christmas, and the Scots lads got together, and they volunteered to do sentry duty on Christmas Eve, on the understanding that they would all be excused such duties on Hogmanay, which went off very well. And then, February, the unit moved en masse up to Brussels, so we took over a factory there. But we had to dismantle a lot of the machinery and then had to chisel out and break up the concrete plinths on which the machinery had been standing before we could use them for workshops. So some of us were doing that job on night duty. So it was a night shift and it was 24 hours labour working on the thing altogether. And I got very funny with a lady of the night at a local estaminet. Well, she had her own private quarters, but she used to operate from the estaminet. And we got on very well together for a while, and then I was getting a bit fed up because I could see the war was coming to a close, and I hadn't got any loot. So I asked for posting forward. And I was sent up eventually to a holding unit with a workshops at just outside Munster. And Munster am Rhine, by the Rhine. And while there, a chap I'd piled up with, we went exploring, and the place was only a couple of days after it had been taken over. And we went into the Big Jetty Barracks, which had been an SS barracks. I've still got the swastika somewhere, a bit moth-eaten by now, that I pinched from there. And my partner and I, we went into one of the messes there, very nicely laid out, half bottles of beer, half glasses, all over the place. And we went up to the bar, big mirror behind it, glass shelves and bottles on the shelves. And we looked at one another without saying a word. We picked up a bottle each and threw it at the mirror. Very destructive, but as far as we're concerned, it could just as well have been broken in the bombardment. But after that, we went exploring through the stores of the bar, and he came away with a couple of a dozen glasses all stacked up and wrapped up in paper, and I took a roll of green and white striped glass fibre, which I carried with me until after the war, and I went on leave and took it home, and my sister wore pyjamas made out of that stuff for ages. From there we moved out a place called Bramshire, just north of Osnabrück, and we're there for the weekend when Jerry capitulated. And over the weekend we moved into a barracks in Osnabrück. And of course we were not allowed to fraternize in those days. My pal and I walked down the street, and there were a couple of gorgeous fräuleins leaning over the fence, chatting away. Quick look around, the coast was clear, vaulted over the fence and into the house like nobody's business. The fraternization ban was soon lifted after that, and we could do it quite legally. I wasn't there for long before eventually I was posted up to a place called Bergen, a little place to the north of Celle, at a crossroads. And actually the crossroads where you turn off to go down the road for a couple of miles to Belsen. We never went as far as Belsen, but many were there for a couple of weeks, and many of the time we had chaps coming around, walking skeletons more or less, in stripes, prison wear, and they're diving into our dustbins for scraps that were thrown away. We couldn't stand that, and we fed them with our food. That was the worst thing we could have done, of course, because our stomachs couldn't cope with it. And I'm afraid one or two of them were victims of our generosity. From there, we went into Celle. We took over the offices and grounds of a salt mine. There's one big mine there. I don't know how deep it was, but there was a huge drum of cable. We tied one end to it to a stanchion and tipped the reel down the mine shaft. Oh, it stayed taut all the time we were there. We never reached the bottom. We soaked some old rags in petrol and put a match to it and dropped it down, and either it burned out or went out of sight long before it reached the bottom. About a month or so later, well, we had been posted to Hanover, and I went on leave and arrived in London on the Sunday morning to find headlines on the placards of an unknown ammunition dump in a mine which had gone sky high. It didn't give any details, and I often wonder whether it was the one where we were, and we set the thing smouldering from weeks before. Whenever I went on leave through London, I made a point of calling in at the Nuffield Club, at an entertainment centre that had been put up by, financed by Lord Nuffield. They had tailors, hairdressers, and as well as being a dance hall and canteen and what have you. And it was a wonderful place. I always remember the tailor. He had a photograph on the wall of himself in Spanish dress of, well, I should say, about the 15th century, tight hose, all the rest of it, and wielding a pair of scissors as though he were a tailor of those days. In April 1948, on leave, and my folks were, of course, were in East Africa by then, and I had two destinations, one down at Portsmouth and one at Aberdeen, where just outside Aberdeen, a little town called Peter Coulter. It was rather amusing because on the boat going over from the Hook of Holland to Harwich, I got talking to a brawny sergeant of the Gordon Highlanders, because Aberdeen was their recruiting ground. And